Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 276. Die Dorsland, the Thirst Land, is part of the Kalahari that has an interesting history when it comes to pastoralists. The sand didn't call it the Thirst Land. For them, it wasn't a barrier, but part of a network of seasonal resource nodes. They would navigate the dry spans using sip wells, inserting long, hollow reeds deep into the damp sand and grass filters to literally suck water up to store in hollowed out ostrich eggshells, then bury these along transit routes for future journeys. Between 2000 and 2500 years ago, a massive economic shift occurred when groups in northern Botswana acquired livestock, sheep, and later cattle, transitioning from hunter-gatherers to pastoralists, becoming the Khoikhoi. Archaeological evidence suggests the Khoikhoi moved out of the northern Botswana Zambezi region and split. One of the major migration routes skirted the western edge of the Kalahari Desert, moving down through modern-day Namibia and into the northern and western Cape, with the Kalahari as the geographic pivot around which this entire pastoralist expansion rotated. Moving large herds of sheep and cattle through a thirst land required moving between reliable pans and riverbeds like the Nosob, the Aub, and the Malopa rivers. They transformed the Kalahari from a hunter-gatherer landscape into a series of strategic grazing corridors. The Dorsland trekkers were going to reverse that course to some extent, using the northwestern Botswana region to reach Namibia and eventually Angola. The Khoikhoi, like the voortrekkers, appreciated their freedom, moving in small, extended family groups, their mobility part of their world view. Instead of heading northwest, like the trekkers, they headed southwest for hundreds of years, arriving in southern Africa around 2,400 years ago. That was about the time parts of South Central Africa experienced a shift in rainfall, the forests and dense woodlands expanded or contracted, and the Tsetse Belt moved. If you were an early pastoralist whose entire wealth and diet and social structure depended on cattle and sheep, a shifting Tsetse Flower Belt was an existential threat. The arid margins of the Kalahari, the Namib, the Karoo, the environments further south were too dry for the Tsetse Fly. The Karoo was a safe haven for livestock, the Namib too desiccated. In high rainfall tropical areas, grass grows fast, but it loses its nutritional value in winter. It becomes sourveld. In more arid regions, like the fringes of the Kalahari and the Karoo, the grass grows slower, but retains its high mineral and protein content year-round, even when dry. It's sweetveld. To a sheep or cow, the arid south was an open buffet of incredibly nutritious feed. The Khoikhoi migration pushed into the Western Cape, where they hit a completely different climate zone, the winter rainfall region. So just as the summer rainfall area dried out, the Cape valleys were greening up. But where the trekkers moved northwards, taking a decade and arriving in Angola in 1880, the Khoikhoi migrations took hundreds of years, a gradual seeping south, if you like. After the Khoikhoi and before the Boers, the people of the Ngami area near the Okavango Delta were known as the Kwebe, from the word Kwe, which simply means people. They dwelt close to a geographical anomaly in Botswana, the Kwebe Hills. Botswana is one of the flattest countries on earth. The Kwebe Hills are a windy place, and Kwebe mythology speaks of the gas bird, which lives in a certain baobab near the upper Okavango River Valley. If you listen closely, you can hear his hissing voice inside the tree. The mythology is linked to earlier sand cosmology, where the word kwe means wind, and where the wind is a supernatural being. The hills have an odd microclimate and composition of soils, and the baobabs there are massive, some 10 meters in circumference. There are marula trees and motsintsela shrubs like the mokwana and the mokompata. Kudu grace the slopes, along with the wildcat, the jackal, leopard, hyena, duika, steenbok, birds like the khori bustard and the ostrich. When the Batawana people arrived there sometime in the late 18th century, the Kwebe did not fight them. They were subsumed by these new arrivals, who themselves were enslaved by the Kololo marauders from the south. Some Batawana escaped to modern-day Zambia, only to return later. Trade links between central Botswana and the south developed. David Livingstone arrived in Ngami land in 1849 to visit Chief Letsholatebe, using a well-known route from the southeast. The chief had taken advantage of a trade route in the opposite direction, making contact with Hambukushi middlemen from Angola, with whom he bartered ivory, ostrich feathers, cattle, and even slaves. The Hambukushi in turn handed over guns and powder, obtained from Portuguese traders in Benguela, the tiny Angolan port, which is now called Lobito. A trackable route could be followed all the way from the Transvaal border up past the Okavango, northwestwards across the Kunene River, then onwards all the way to the Angolan coast by the mid-1800s. The Kwebe Hills were located in a malaria zone and therefore left alone most of the time by Europeans, until 1868, when legendary Boer hunter Hendrik Matthijs van Sail settled there. His life story is somewhat epic. He was an early member of the Cape Parliament, then left to join the Voortrekkers of the 1830s, lived in the Transvaal for a while, but he was a restless man and wandered off into the Kalahari sands, where he befriended many local chiefs. He reached Lake Ngami with his ox wagon and remained there for 2 years, trading ostrich skins and young slaves to the Western Transvaal Boers, although they denied this, but the evidence was clear. In 1871, he was given a large parcel of land by the chief, Khosi Letsho Latebe, which stretched from the Kwebe Hills to Ganzi, more than 100 square kilometers of land. In exchange, he was expected to help the king fight off raids from the Damara and the Namaqua Khoisan, who launched attacks from the west in Namibia. By the late 1870s, Van Sail had built up a reputation famous for his bravery and hunting elephants, and as a great white chief whose tribe included white, black and Khoisan, all paying him tribute. He built a double-story house full of French furniture, including a piano, and was kept busy by his more than 100 San and Kwe concubines. An almost mythological figure, he was solely responsible for almost wiping all elephants out in this part of southern Africa. In 1877, he shot 400 elephants in less than a week. In 1878, he shot 103 in 1 day. His method, chasing them to the marshes of a drying pan. From that day onward, it has been called Olifantspan. The Dorpsland trekkers were to pass through Van Sail's territory later, when his wild frontier luck eventually ran out. Van Sail was to disappear after two violent incidents. First, a young trekker called Prinsloo, part of the Dorpsland trekkers, was murdered, and in revenge, Van Sail ordered 33 San women to be shot. After this heinous act, he rode off on a short trip to Angola, but he never arrived at his destination. Historians believe he was murdered in turn for his extreme act of retribution. Following which, Van Sail's house was ransacked and burnt down. Bits of what remains can still be found at Ganzi Farm No. 1. The legend of Van Sail grew in his absence, but the stories did not go unnoticed. In 1872, the Transvaal elected Burgers as president. He was highly educated, progressive, and a modernizing leader who wanted to build railways and secularize education. To the ultra-conservative, deeply religious Dopa faction of Boers, led spiritually by figures like Lo Du Plessis, Burgers was a dangerous heretic. They genuinely believed his godless government would bring divine judgment upon the land. The British were pushing for a confederation of southern African states and were about to annex the Transvaal in 1877. And their drive to emancipate slaves and allow blacks more rights meant that for these Dorpers, living under the British flag was an absolute non-negotiable. Perhaps the biggest motivation of all to leave was Burger's introduction of a direct taxation to fund his grand infrastructure schemes. For the fiercely independent frontiersmen, a government that mapped their land and taxed their property and conscripted them into state-run militias called the commandos amounted to tyranny from which these biblical people should flee. Another day, another pharaoh. A further reason the Dorpsland trekkers left the Transvaal was because they owned no land. When the first trekkers arrived in the Transvaal, every burgher was entitled to own 2 farms of 3,000 acres each. In 1859, that was reduced to 1. In 1869, the Volksraad banned further land registration because there was none left. A group of trekkers felt ostracized and their gaze turned northwest. The Voortrekkers had always sought out a northern future, and in the 1870s, early explorers and hunters like Van Sail had brought back half-baked stories of a vast watery wilderness in the north, the Okavango, and southern Angola. The trekkers distorted these reports into a biblical promised land, the New Canaan, if not of milk and honey, then at least brandy and biltong. Deeply millenarian and religious, many trekkers viewed themselves as the Israelites fleeing Egypt. Some factions were genuinely convinced that if they just kept trekking north, they would eventually reach Jerusalem, or a land prepared directly for them by God. While the Khoi Khoi had travelled light, the trekkers did not. Between 1875 and 1880, several waves of fur trekkers left the Transvaal, where hundreds of people and thousands of cattle were to perish of thirst, malaria, murder, and exhaustion along the trail. The paths became literal trails of bleached bones and abandoned wagons before the survivors finally limped into northern Namibia and eventually Angola. The first of these waves started out in May 1874 when Hans van der Merwe and Gert Alberts departed from the Elands River in Groot Mariko district along with 13 families. They didn't have any specific destination in mind, they just wanted to leave the Transvaal. A smaller group of the families of Gerhardus Martinus Smit and Petrus Crisparus Jacobs left shortly after the van der Merwe Alberts trek, but they turned back at a place they called Die Meer, just south of the Okavango Delta. Malaria had begun to kill off the children, and the price of freedom was just too high. The second main group of seven families met at Sopanslechte on the Apies River in late April 1875, then departed the Transvaal in 1877. They were led by Commandant Jan Greiling and Veldkornet Duplessis, but there was tension in the camp. Both Greiling and Duplessis were apparently bad leaders, and others stepped in to take over the role of leadership during their years of wandering. Upon hearing of this venture, other Boers joined this group. Eventually, there were more than 100 families travelling in 128 wagons, about 480 people in total. Joining them were 2,000 draft oxen, 7,500 head of cattle, 500 horses, 1,000 sheep and goats, 32 donkeys, 200 dogs and 500 chickens. Had you been minding your own business in the Kalahari back in 1877 and been confronted by this horde, it would have been quite a shock. But the Dorsland could not sustain a group of this size. This was the trek that suffered most from hunger and thirst in the Kalahari Desert. Dozens died of malaria and other fevers when they reached Okavango. Survivors would later describe this terrible trek as the most painful chapter in the whole history of the Afrikaner race. A small trek band left Rustenburg in 1877, 8 families, 40 people, led by Jacobus Frederik Boete. In total, about 600 Boers were on their way to their promised land of Angola, although where exactly they would stop was a matter of debate. Fewer than half would arrive in Angola. A quarter died of disease, poisoned by wild plants, killed in hunting accidents, or murdered by the sand on the way. More than 100 others gave up and returned to the Transvaal. One mother told the trekker Reverend Jan Leon Cachet that,
"If we ever wanted to return to the Transvaal but had forgotten the way, we could find it by following the graves of our little ones."
About 50 burghers who gave up and turned around hated the idea of returning to the Transvaal so much that they preferred to settle at the main village of Bakwena chief Khosi Sesheli Motswaseli. He hired the Boers as hunters and carpenters, blacksmiths, wainwrights, cattle farmers. Later, they'd become known as Karma's Boers, as Nicole Stassen points out in her book The Boers in Angola. Some mischievous journalists called them the white slaves of the Molopololi. They weren't slaves, but they were his vassals paying tribute to the chief. Sesheli employed whites mainly as builders, including these Boer artisans, who built a large modern rectangular stone and brick house with glazed windows and a corrugated iron roof located alongside his traditional wapa. Visitors to Sesheli's private quarters described an extraordinary mix of luxury, including high-end European furniture, iron bedsteads, and fine English tea services, sitting alongside beautifully cured leopard skin rugs or dikobo, traditional ivory ornaments, stacks of Botswana firearms bundled nearby. A smaller group of these Dorsland trekker returnees headed southwest, settling near Gobabas in Namibia. Others went to Gunzi, close to Van Sale's old farm, where their descendants live to this day. Gunzi is in the middle of the Kalahari on the western edge of Botswana, and Gobabas almost directly west inside modern-day Namibia, just to the east of Windhoek. Since those days, there's been a long tradition of individual families trekking back and forth between Gunzi, Molopololi, and Angola. Even today, off-road motorbike adventurers can be found crisscrossing these dusty roads, an echo of an earlier era. There was a lot of wandering about for the first few years, particularly in the north of Namibia, close to the Kanini River. It was here that the Portuguese priest, Father Carlos da Porque, of the Congregation du Saint-Esprit et de Saint-Cœur de Marie, met trekkers and asked them to go to Umpata, a fertile area of what was known as Portuguese West Africa, we know as Angola. In September 1880, 57 families joined up near the Cunene in northern Namibia, nearly 300 people in all, with 61 wagons pulled by 840 draft oxen, driving 200 head of cattle, 120 horses, 3,000 sheep and goats. In a momentous moment, this group entered Angola. A small delegation of Boers rode ahead to Mocamedesh, where they met with Portuguese governor Sebastião de Mata and negotiated land rights. The negotiations went well, which was a surprise, because the Boers could not speak Portuguese and the governor could not speak Dutch. Neither group spoke the region's lingua franca either, English. They didn't even speak French. An agreement was ratified on the 28th of December 1880, but the Reverend Jan Leon Cochet had his doubts about what was going on, noting in his journal that there had already been much trouble and he foresaw more of the same. He wasn't wrong. The Dorpsland Trekkers were Protestant Calvinists, Dorpers of the Gereformeerde Kerk, and the Portuguese, well, they were Catholic. They viewed the Catholic Church not just as a different religion, but as a spiritual adversary. The Portuguese government, inherently linked to the Catholic Church, assumed the Boers would assimilate or at least respect state-sanctioned Catholicism. The agreement they had signed in December had a section on voortrekkers adhering to the rules of the Portuguese, including their religion. Instead, the Trekkers immediately demanded their own Dutch language schools and Calvinist churches, flatly refusing to let Catholic priests near their children. This is precisely why the Reverend Jan Leon Cochet was there, to maintain the Calvinist ways. He saw the immediate fundamental impossibility of a fiercely anti-Catholic community surviving happily under a deeply Catholic colonial state. But both the Portuguese and the Boers had to make this work. For the Portuguese, the abolition of slavery meant they were promoting white colonization in the interior of Angola and believed the Boers could play a role in this regard. For the Boers, failing in Angola meant returning to the Transvaal and the accursed English. In November 1882, the governor naturalized the Humpata Boers as Portuguese citizens without them asking. From now on, they'd be known as the Boers Portugueses. By the mid-1890s, the Boers had spread out across the interior of Angola to Bié, Mombola, Ké, Cubal, Kakonda, Hanya, Sacandjimba, making a living from farming and hunting and transport riding for the Portuguese. This wasn't the end of the Dorpsland trekking. Over the next two decades, more Boers would follow these early waves into Angola, particularly after the Second Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902. And then, of course, during the border wars of the 1970s and 80s, thousands of the descendants of the trekkers would cross again in numerous operations. There's a deep association between South Africa and Angola. For more on this, please listen to my series, South African Border Wars, available on all major platforms. Next, we'll join Quechua Kampandi as he sets sail to England in order to meet Queen Victoria. Behind the pomp and ceremony was a fractious Zululand, which was about to subside into civil war. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens.